the existential threat to human existence as we know it.
Duck and cover.
Life jackets are mandatory.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
We're all going to die!
The thing is a nothing burger.
That was a big nothing burger.
I've done a lot of doomsday shows. I have an entire library of doomsday episodes. Doomsday by nuclear war, plague, alien invasion, meteor strike. In every case, it's a goof. Doomsday for fun. People have been predicting the end of the world since the beginning of the world, always based on some impending catastrophe that never quite materializes, or at least not with the predicted severity. Remember the Mayan calendar? That was a good one. Scientists, who studied the squiggles and doohickeys on it, claimed that it ended in the year 2012, so of course, that year the world was sure to end, because some guy chiseling a stone wheel 1,000 years ago was sure to know. But nobody ever said that, hey, maybe that stone cutter had to take a leak, and when he walked out to the edge of the jungle, a puma ripped his throat out.
The safari park.
You're killing me, Larry!
Larry. Fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
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 Come on, Larry. Larry. Larry.
The world was supposed to end, or at least descend into anarchy, when hundreds of millions of digital devices built in the previous century would go haywire because no provision had been made for the new millennium. Planes were going to fall out of the sky. Trillions would vanish from Wall Street. Home computers would fritz out, then explode. I well recall, New Year's Eve 1999, my wife and I and our newborn were visiting friends in the town of Millbrook, New York. It had one claim to fame. For a time in the mid-1960s, LSD guru Timothy Leary occupied a mansion there. Leary's place was allegedly the scene of continuous psychedelic-fueled orgies. Well, there was no acid or orgy at our party, just a dozen or so ordinary people. There had been a fair amount of drinking, of course, and as midnight approached, everyone gathered at the TV to watch the new millennium arrive around the globe via satellite hookup. New Year's in Tokyo, Manila, New Delhi, Cairo, Athens, Rome, Berlin, Paris, London. As 2000 rang in, city by city, somebody at the party decided that the proper ambiance for the occasion would be a blinding strobe light and set it up, plugged it in, switched it on. It was like being inside the climax of Looking for Mr. Goodbar. I wondered if I might begin the new millennium with a seizure. At the same time, I realized that LSD was not necessary for a bad trip. Finally, the satellite hookup delivered Dick Clark high atop Times Square for the big moment. As the countdown began, I snuck outside into foot-deep snow, took a leak in the moonlight. Something moved in the woods. A deer. I asked him if he was worried about Y2K. He told me he was not. Then he vanished. I remained outside as long as I could tolerate the cold. Once back indoors, nobody mentioned Y2K. Not one plane fell from the sky. My laptop did not blow up, and Wall Street got richer. Life went on. A lot of people take doomsday shit very seriously. Why is that? Some are just phony cretins making political hay, like former vice president and climate change and carbon credit hustler Al Gore. When Al left office in 1992, his estimated net worth was $850,000. According to MoneyInc.com, Al is currently worth about 330 million. How'd he do that? Looks like climate change pays, huh? And pays. Another creep feeding the climate doom boom is this mental lightweight.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
That, of course, is AOC, who made that prediction 3 years ago now, so we better start getting our affairs in order. Doom merchants have their own all-purpose catchphrase that covers any and all doomsday scenarios, don't they? An existential threat! You see that label slapped on everything from GMOs to now the unvaccinated. This fear-mongering by politician parasites, it's not new. They just they change up the threat with whatever's trending. During the Cold War, it was nuclear war with the Russians. And the message was capitulation or annihilation. That was bullshit. Even the Cuban Missile Crisis was wildly exaggerated by the media to bolster the narrative as well as JFK's approval ratings. After the Bay of Pigs fiasco in the spring of 61, Kennedy was looking like a big incompetent loser. The so-called Missile Crisis was a great opportunity to polish his tarnished image as a leader. Hey, I'm getting off track here. So after those who use doomsday to leverage a political agenda, next in line are those whose lives are so fucking meaningless and mundane or unpleasant and unbearable that the prospect of the apocalypse provides some needed diversion and relief. Ask an infantryman taking mortar fire if he's worried about the climate, or some dude on a gurney being wheeled into an OR for some dicey surgery. They won't give a micro damn about existential threats. All they want to do is take their next breath. Just about every week you see a fresh doomsday scenario from some asshole. Some are hoping it was last week's underwater volcano in the Pacific that triggered tsunami warnings here on the West Coast. That tsunami hit the shore like a school of sardines. If they can't concoct a fresh premise for global destruction, they'll always find another angle. As have some clowns in Tasmania. Yeah, they claim to be building Earth's black box, like a flight recorder for this doomed planet. The monolith will have internet connectivity and record all major events about climate change, which, at this rate, is likely to spell doom for most of humanity, unquote. Wow. Now, there's some even-handed journalism, huh? And I checked the byline, and incredibly, it wasn't AOC. Must be somebody just as smart. It goes on. Presuming that we continue on this path, sea levels are likely to rise and crops will fail. Feeding billions of people will be impossible, and we might enter a Mad Max kind of post-apocalyptic world where oil is in excess, but water is scarce. They couldn't get any oil, there was no gas. But anyway, it goes on. If following generations want to know what went wrong, Earth's black box will offer the history of humanity and what it did or did not do to avert the calamity. Unquote. So, what's in the box, you ask? Quote, a mass of storage drives that record streams of data about land and sea temperatures, ocean acidification levels, humanity's energy consumption, and carbon dioxide levels. Unquote. Now here's where it gets really good. Supplementing this information will be news headlines, social media posts, to provide context on what humanity did while the climate worsened. So once climate change destroys mankind, visiting aliens can find out what happened from old Twitter posts from blue check morons, OnlyFans porn stars, and Don Lemon. So what about power for this box? Well, solar, of course, with a battery backup. The engineering wizards figure the thing will function for 30 to 50 years. So that kind of infers doom is right around the corner. Capping the story is the best line of all. How will future generations know what the monolith contains and how to access information on it is a puzzle the researchers are yet to solve. Ooh. Now, this black box story was pretty widely distributed all over the internet. What percentage of people read that and bought into every idiotic, false, and ludicrous line? Probably a lot. Probably at least half. Have people become that stupid? Most of our educational system sucks. They actively strive to make kids stupid, to believe bullshit and trust authority, who, as a general rule, are most likely to lie to us. In the spiritual realm, at least in the Christian one, a common petition of the Almighty, or at least the Holy Ghost, usually depicted by that dove with the sun rays shooting out of his feathers, that petition is for the gift of discernment. In 21st century parlance, discernment would be termed a fine-tuned and sensitive bullshit detector. If more people had the gift of discernment, the world would be such a better place. Commies would be sussed out before they could metastasize. Divorce would plummet. So would drug addiction. People would elect leaders who lead instead of parasites that destroy them. Most of life's big mistakes are made due to a lack of discernment. As a kid, there was a local dude I'd hang out with. We named Mike the Mighty Greek. He was a good dude. He was one of those guys who knew something about damn near everything. He could fix any problem on a car, build furniture, his own ham radios and computers, stuff like that. Once as a winter project, he bought a UPS truck and outfitted it like the plushest Airstream trailer. It was magnificent. He was one of those guys who are now in very short supply in this keyboard economy of disposable everything. My partner in the country western band, Pontiac Pete, and I would park in Mike's kitchen as Mike's wife kept the coffee hot while an assortment of Mike's friends would just kind of drift in and out through the evening. Shift workers from the airport, linemen for the phone company, advertising execs, college professors. It was a wild melange. Every one of them brought something interesting to the table. It was like a TV talk show without the cameras or audience. But there was a band. At some point in the evening, Mike would demand Pete and I pull our guitars from the car trunks. We'd do a couple of sets right there in the kitchen. We were heavy on Waylon and Willie, with some bluegrass, Eagles, Hank Williams, and so on. Very country. Pete would lay in some Paul Simon and James Taylor just to stir the pot. Every time I'd leave one of those gatherings, usually at 1 or 2 a.m., I was richer than when I arrived. Mike was a font of wisdom and experience. Nobody ever said that, but on some level we all knew it. Along with the jokes and rants about commies, there were often detours into people's personal struggles. Somebody going through a divorce or a financial setback or a serious illness. The conversation could swing from hilarity to heartbreak in just a few sentences. Being maybe 19 or 20, I rarely stuck my two cents in. I mostly listened. Everyone else at those hangouts had a decade or two on Pete and me. Someone's dilemma would be tossed around like a medicine ball, and it always seemed to last land in the lap of the guy with the right prescription, Mike. He always had the soundest advice. I spent thousands of wasted days sitting in classrooms listening to useless nonsense. Mike's kitchen offered a crash course in life, and I still remember a lot of what he said. He had tremendous powers of discernment. For instance, I don't know whether he borrowed this line or came up with it himself, but it doesn't matter because its truth is immutable. It's a quotation that could not be more valuable in these insane times where lemmings screech that we must follow the science. Mike said, and this is a near verbatim quote, "The primary concern of the practitioners of any profession is the exclusion of the layman." Unquote. Ain't that the truth? Every profession has its own lingo, and the guys in the union are never very eager to translate. And if they deign to do so, we're at their mercy because they can embellish or omit or distort. Same as a translator could anywhere in the world. You really need a second translator you can trust, don't you? Everyone from plumbers and mechanics to neurosurgeons and physicists have their own vernacular. Oh, I should have added epidemiologists and virologists to that list, shouldn't I? One evening at Mike's, the subject of the Beatles came up. Somebody said they were awesome songwriters. Mike took a drag on his cigarette and asked, "How do you know they write all their own songs?" The guy kind of shrugged, but Mike's question stuck with me. And a few nights ago, I caught some of the Get Back documentary about the Beatles. In the hour or so that I watched, they were struggling to write some songs. I did not hear any mind-blowing musicianship or guitar virtuosity. George Harrison, God bless his honesty, complained that he lacked Eric Clapton's chops. Ringo sat on his drum kit, bored out of his skull, while the other guys tossed off disjointed licks, riffs, snorts, and mouthbox percussion. Who took all that gravel and slag and sculpted it into hit songs? As I viewed that segment, my mind slingshot back decades to Mike's kitchen and his very canny question. Of course, it's possible they had bursts of songsmithing genius when alone and away from the cameras. Or maybe a better name for the Beatles would have been George Martin and his Mop Top Quartet. You never realize when you're in the middle of magic until it's gone. I don't ever remember thinking, gee, I haven't hung out with Pete at Mike's kitchen for a while. I think I'll head over there and see what's happening. You just find yourself somewhere else with a fresh cast of characters. Funny how life works that way. You don't notice your teeth until one of them starts to ache. And when we're very young, we tend to think of everything and everyone as frozen in time, as if old people always were old and always would be old. As if everyone was some kind of a character, static and unchanging. The conclaves at Mike's were like a surrogate family for all participants. Not that we were orphans, everybody had their own families, but what made hanging there so great was we were all familiar enough to be comfortable, but not so much that friction would build, as it will, in any family. We'd disperse, go about our lives, and reconvene the next week. And amazingly, it was never planned. There was no set evening or time. We just serendipitously coalesced. There were no text messages. Nobody called anyone and said, "Hey, want to meet at Mike's tonight?" We just showed up. And there would be Mike at the head of the table, holding court, his wife leaning on the stove beside the always percolating coffee pot. How did those gatherings happen? I don't know. How do birds fly in formation or coyotes run in packs? Some kind of instinct. It seems when most people gather, it's rarely, purely, for the reason of sharing each other's company. There must always be some reason, some shared diversion, huh? A poker game or bowling league. And those things are fun, but they're still a social crutch. None was needed at Mike's kitchen. When I moved to L.A., I had a friend who worked for a studio and had a massive video screen in his house, and he'd get hold of movies way before they were released. A couple of times he invited me to his movie nights. Maybe a dozen people would show up, the lights would go down, the movie would begin, the lights would go up, everyone would go home. I recall sitting in a lounge chair, watching whatever the hell the yet-to-be-released tentpole flick was, and thinking, why the fuck am I here? Why are these other people here? In a few weeks, for a few bucks, you can have this exact same experience at a movie theater. Sit in silence, surrounded by strangers, and then go home. I felt lonesome as hell. Remembered Mike and Pete, and the gang in Mike's kitchen. Wished I could find a time machine. Hell, I've gone off the rails again. Doom is a business, big business. In fact, the biggest business. The military, healthcare, pharmaceuticals are all ostensibly in the doom prevention business, aren't they? Keep us safe, keep us healthy, keep us narcotized. Politician parasites have jumped into doom prevention with both feet. Once upon a time, their job was to make sure the roads are paved and the garbage collected. Now, they're going to keep us safe. Safe from disease, safe from attack, safe from malicious employers, safe from misgendering and misinformation. I don't know where discernment comes from. Maybe if you pray hard enough to the Holy Ghost, he'll deliver some like a holy drone. I used to think it was cultivated on mean urban streets, but when you see how stultifyingly stupid most American cities have become, no. It does not come with age. Plenty of dumb old jackasses. Just look at American politicians. So it looks like we're down to that time machine in Mike the Mighty Greek's kitchen in Bayside, Queens. Hell, maybe Mike had already built one himself. He always looked as if he was laughing at a private joke. Maybe his private joke was the future. Thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Slide over to the show page at thatlarryshow.com for hundreds more episodes. And while you're there, be sure to click the subscribe button. You never miss a show that way, and it doesn't cost a thing. There are only two kinds of people in this world. Astcos, that's assholes seeking to control others, and Lutfas, that's leave us the fuck alone. Lutfa is the belief on which America and all free societies are founded. If you want to show your membership and support for Lutfa ideals, you can do it with a very cool magnetic sticker. Go to thatlarryshow.com, scroll down a little, and see how great they'll look on your vehicle, refrigerator, stove hood, anything metal, really. They're weatherproof and only 10 bucks each or 3 for 25. Just click the PayPal button at thatlarryshow.com and be sure to mention the word Lutfa with your order. Now, if you want access to dozens of bonus episodes, where we sometimes get a little more personal and contentious, click the Patreon button to unlock those shows. Oh, and if you want a taste of the Doomsday Suite, maybe try episode 121, Larry Predicts Armageddon, that's in the August 2018 tab, or, this one's a weird one, Meet the Fisters, episode 266. In the July 2020 tab, all at thatlarryshow.com. My friends, doomsday will arrive whenever it damn pleases, and nothing people are doing will alter the date of that event. However, life can be a living hell when Astcos are in charge. Fight them at every turn. I'll see you next Wednesday or thereabouts, and until that time, take no shit.